bring up then early next week. For WGTD News, I'm Gregory Berg. WGTD News time is 8:10. The morning show is next. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to be welcoming back into our studios today Nan Calvert, who is, of course, a monthly visitor to the morning show, and we're always so glad to have her. And we're especially excited about today's program. I know Nan is, and I am as well, because our topic will be one that is near and dear to her heart, namely native plants. But we have a very special guest who is joining us via the telephone, who is also an expert in this field, and we'll be exploring quite a lot with him. First of all, Nan Calvert, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. Good morning, everybody.
And I hope that on the phone with us is Mikkel Ond. And I hope I'm pronouncing that name at least somewhat close to correct. Are you with us?
You're close. It's Mikkel Ond, as an and.
Okay.
Yes.
Mikkel Ond.
Exactly.
We appreciate you joining us today on the morning show. Thank you. So, Nan Calvert, explain the kind of interesting story by which you came to know Mikkel, and at least a little bit, and are going to get to know him better now.
Yes. Yeah, so, interestingly enough, it was by way of Maine. There's a permaculturist in Maine by the name of Jesse Stevens, and I follow him. And he posted one day about a plant called American groundnut, Apios americana. And I was really interested in it, did some reading on it, and then I asked him if he knew anyone who propagated it, and he gave me Mikkel's name. And, of course, Mikkel is in Wisconsin, so it was a roundabout way of finding Mikkel and then chatting with him briefly. I'm intensely interested in how our native plants were used for sustenance. You know, First Americans, First Nations people use them all of the time, and it's knowledge that we don't necessarily have or that we forgot, but it's something that we need to talk about because really, when you look at a native landscape, a healthy, diverse native landscape, it's kind of a grocery store. It's a cornucopia of edibles and very nutritious ones as well. So that's what we're going to talk about today, native plants that are edible.
Very good. So, Mikhail, and again, we are so happy to have you join us. And tell us exactly where you are joining us from. I mean, where are you located?
I live in a community called Dreamtime Village, which is located in a tiny, tiny, tiny little village called West Lima, L-I-M-A, West Lima, which is in Richland County.
So can you give for us Southerners here in Wisconsin at least a rough idea of what you are near?
I'm halfway between Madison and La Crosse.
Ah, okay.
Like almost exactly.
Very good. Tell us where you're from originally. Are you a Wisconsin native?
I was born in Rapids, in the armpit of Wisconsin. I grew up smelling Kraft Mills my whole life, and I'm so glad to be out in the Driftless where I don't have to smell that kind of thing anymore. And then after that, I went to college for a few years, and I ended up in Madison all through the 80s. And the neighborhood that I was living in turned into a crack neighborhood about the end of, like, 1990 or so. We had my first wife and I had a little boy, and it just wasn't safe to be around there, so we fled to the country. That's where I am now.
So tell us about your own interest in native plants, which I assume is also part of just kind of a general interest in the natural world. Is this something that was important to you as a youngster growing up, or is this an interest that took hold later?
Well, first, I'd like to clarify that I have a lot of interest in native plants. That's not actually my specialty. I'm much more interested in edible landscaping, permaculture. And one of the things to keep in mind with edible landscaping is that most of the things that we know as edible fruits that can grow in Wisconsin are not native. They are actually, most of them are from northern Asia, Kazakhstan, and areas around there. And so they've been in this country for hundreds of years, but they're not technically native. And so there are native fruits that grow in Wisconsin, but there is actually not that many. I know a lot of stuff about native plants, and it's totally integrated into what I do, but it's not my specialty.
Understood.
And to answer your question, I got into when I was a kid. I wasn't really that interested. Most of my life I've been a poet and a musician and a performance artist. At one point while I was living in Madison, my first wife and I started growing gourds on Williamson Street in Madison, and we didn't have any. There was no garden, no yard, no nothing. So we built giant boxes and found soil someplace and put soil in the boxes, and we started growing very, very large gourds for drying and making music instruments out of. And as we were a performance group, we made our own music instruments, invented our own tonality and our own just total. Our own unique approach to performing and music. And so that was actually my entrance into growing things. And then when we moved out into the country where there's just so much land and so much space to do things, in about 1990 or so, I got introduced to permaculture as a movement. And it wasn't really, it was hardly a word you ever heard in Wisconsin. It wasn't something that was practiced in the Midwest. There was very, very few people doing it out here. And primarily it was, in Southwest United States. And, of course, it originated in Australia, so it was very popular in Australia and some European countries. Being out in this little town, we had started a community called Dreamtime Village, an intentional community. And we actually hosted at our community the first permaculture intensive. And by intensive, I mean 17 days, 14 hours a day. The first permaculture intensive to introduce permaculture to Wisconsin. This is 1992. It really sort of brought permaculture teachers and designers from all over the world to our thing, to our event. Brought a lot of different students, and it also at the same time helped us figure out what to do with all the different sorts of properties and stuff that we had out here in terms of design and what to plant, what not to plant, and how to plant and so forth, and how to integrate it actually into our community. That's kind of my background, I guess, in terms of how I got into it. And since then, one of the main things that I've been doing is that when you start planting fruit and nuts and berries and native plants and herbs, pretty quickly you get way, way more than one person can use or a couple people can use. And so you start to learn how to put it up in different ways. And my own interest, because a lot of what I was really focusing on growing were the fruits, was fermentation. And I got into winemaking pretty early on. And so I've been really focusing on making wine from all the different kinds of fruits and stuff that I've been growing over the years, as a way of preserving it, but also as a way of sort of capturing the essence of these kinds of plants. And so my wines are very, very fruit forward. They're not sweet. They're dry. They're really, the emphasis is on that the fact that they're made with fruit, with almost no additives. They're very natural and so forth.
Interesting. Before we explore a little more about permaculture, I'd love to have you explain to our listeners a little more about that term that I think some of them will be acquainted with, intentional community. This is where you live. Explain just in general what that term represents, and then specifically the kind of intentional community in which you now make your home.
It's a word that's kind of cropped up maybe in the last 20 or 30 years. I think in some ways the real reason the word cropped up is to differentiate it from the word communes, which is what, whenever unrelated people are living together, that's kind of the sort of mass mentality about what it is. But our community is much more interested in it's not a commune. It's much more interested in creating a space where people can do things, live together, but have their own separate lives, and then share ownership of the different properties and the responsibilities and so forth. And it, over the years, you know, intentional communities tend to be fairly volatile. So over the years, we've had as many as 25 people living here, and we've had as many as four people living here. So, I mean, it really, really depends. I literally get letters and emails and calls every day of people who want to move out of the city and want to be in the country and want to be in a community and stuff. The issue is, I think the issue for a lot of folks is that they have this very utopian view of what it is to be in an intentional community or living out in the middle of the country. And it's hard work. I mean, it's a different set of life choices, and you do different sets of things, and you're responsible in much different ways. In lots of ways, you have a lot more independence because you're not connected to a landlord and to different sorts of systems that you deal with in an urban setting. We live in Wisconsin, so there's all winter long you have to figure out how to heat your houses and keep your houses heated and keep your population going and so forth. So it becomes a very, very interesting alternative. There are, I don't know, there's maybe 500 intentional communities in the United States. The number kind of fluctuates and changes. A certain percentage of the intentional communities are religious-based. Another percentage of it are based on things for different kinds of issues of equality among people and stuff. Our community tends to be much more focused, sort of has much more of an art focus, and we actually exist as a nonprofit arts organization who owns all the different properties and so forth.
Very good. Thank you for explaining that. For those of you just joining us today on The Morning Show, first of all, it's Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. We're so glad that we have her here. And via the telephone, a guest that she has invited to join us, Mikkel End. And as Nan recounted at the outset of the program today, Nan ended up reaching out to Mikkel End because he was recommended to her when she was in search of a particular edible native plant, And it turns out that Mikhail Ann knows at least something about that, and mostly about the edible green things around us, or edibles of all different colors, I suppose. And so we're going to be kind of exploring a lot of that. So Mikhail, as you were saying, you're not specifically an expert on edible native plants so specifically, but that is in a sense.
Well, I would say I know a lot about edible plants. It's just that there's a lot of different. I hedge at native because there's many different approaches to native, and in the world of native plants, there are some people who are super super strict about what is native and what's not. Personally, those kinds of, because I'm trying to create wild systems, I'm not. I mean, I use natives all the time, and I integrate them, and I work with them and stuff like that, but I'm not focused on creating environments with the natives. To me, I mean, one of the issues actually with native plants is if you're starting out and you want to plant a lot of native plants and you go to a nursery to buy native plants, you're going to spend a lot of money buying native plants until you learn how to propagate things yourself and collect seed yourself. And my focus... I run a small nursery, and I sell permaculture and edible landscaping plants at the Viroqua Farmers Market and then by appointment out of my place here. And so my focus for my nursery has been creating access to these plants for folks that don't have a lot of money. So my plants sell for maybe 30% of what you would pay in a nursery, maybe even less than that. And I also... While I work at the farm, or when I'm at the farmer's market, I'm also the person that every single person brings photographs and says, what is this? What's this disease? What's going on? What is this thing in my yard, et cetera, et cetera. So my emphasis is much more on creating access to information and creating access to learning propagation and growing skills yourself. And so I really focus on younger folks who can't just throw money at something and make it magically appear. They have to, they're doing it through a process of just do it yourself, DIY.
So before we go any further, I think we should circle back to this intriguing term of permaculture, which I know quite a few of our listeners are going to be very well acquainted with, but I'm sure there are people listening who really don't understand what that term represents. Explain what we mean by permaculture and how that folds into the work that you do.
Well, there's many layers of permaculture. I think the easiest way to think about it is as creating systems that model what nature already does. And this may be shocking to your listeners, but in the world of permaculture, the concept of weeds does not exist. There's no such thing as weeds. All plants have their use. All plants exist on the planet. And so in permaculture, you learn how to work with things. So even if you're in a native landscape, for instance, a permaculture thing is dealing with garlic mustard, which is a horrible invasive that gets everywhere. But in permaculture, you're... have recipe books of all the different things you can make out of garlic mustard as you're trying to remove it from your plantings and so forth. So it has a much more utilitarian approach to these things. It's not, and also I think permaculture in many ways tends to be much more focused on organics. Most permaculture folks don't do a lot of spraying. They don't use a lot of pesticides. They usually, because they're working with nature, they tend to use natural approaches to dealing whatever issues appear. Permaculture is also an ecological design system. So because it's based on sort of design concepts, people apply permaculture to lots of different things. There's lots of communities in the Intentional Community Network that are based on permaculture principles. An example of a permaculture principle is the most amount of change with the least amount of effort. So the idea is to look at something and think, well, what do I want to make? What do I want to do? And how do I do it in a way that uses the least amount of resources and the least amount of my energy? That's just a very, very simple example. I mean, there's people who have spent, their whole lives fine-tuning approaches to permaculture. And one of the beauties of permaculture is that it looks different in every single place. Everyone has different approaches. It's really like an open source kind of relationship to growing plants and growing food and growing abundance in your environment.
Nan, do you have anything you want to add to that comment about permaculture and what it is?
Well, not so much in terms of what permaculture is, but, you know, when you think about native plants, for example, I can go outside where I live there's an abundance of berries and other things that I can, you know, just pick and pop in my mouth, and they're there year after year after year. So that's a very simple way of looking at permaculture. And then when you think about all of the kinds of shrubby species that are native to Wisconsin that produce berries that are delicious and nutritious, you can plant a whole landscape of those.
Exactly.
And not necessarily ever have to go to the grocery store to get what you need, unless you need to supplement. And then, you know, protein sources, nuts are very high in protein and good fats. And so people are always shocked and surprised when I tell them that hazelnuts or filberts are native to Wisconsin. And yes, you too can grow those. A few years ago, I don't remember exactly when it was, Greg, but we had Mark Shepard on, who's a very famous permaculturist.
Mark lives about 3 miles from my house.
Yeah, yes.
Ah, wow.
So he's a very successful grower of native and non-native hazelnuts and mushrooms and all kinds of things. So we do have lots of examples in Wisconsin of very successful permaculture, and also integrating native plants into that permaculture, because, you know, those were the first food producers that we had here in Wisconsin and actually all over. It's actually fairly easy to do once you increase your knowledge base. And I would say that in terms of the cost of native plants, it depends on where you go, at what native plant nursery you use as a source for your plants. So, you know, yes, sometimes depending on the plant species, they can be more expensive. It also depends on the seed harvest or however it is that they're being propagated. But yeah, it can be done. And there are pretty straightforward non-chemical ways to introduce those into your landscape.
I think also in a lot of urban settings, finally, city councils and so forth are coming around with native plantings and permaculture, edible landscaping plantings in yards in the city. That's really been a huge change since when I first started, where, especially out here, I mean, a lot of these little towns did not allow you to, you know, they wanted you to have a mowed lawn in your yard and nothing else. They didn't want to have anything messy. They didn't want to have anything that dropped fruit on the ground, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's been a real awakening. Like a place like Madison, there are hundreds and hundreds of yards that have either native plantings or edible landscaping in them. Mm-hmm. And it's just been amazing to see this sort of, the people adopt it easily, but the laws and the particular sorts of cities and their attitudes are a lot slower. Because it's like they're thinking about what's my insurance liability rather than how will the people that live in this town be fed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The priorities are different for the people versus the community legislators and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to return to something that, Mikhail, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you essentially kind of said this, and that is the fact that when we use a term like native plants, that there is a little bit of leeway, or that maybe there is more than one understanding of exactly what a native plant is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In my life, I've encountered a lot of resistance from a certain sort of genre of native plant people who are very by the book. And what I like to tell people is one of the nuts I like to grow is ginkgo. And so ginkgo, which is also known as the dinosaur tree or fossil tree because it's so old, ginkgo was native in Wisconsin a million years ago. Right, so in my mind, it's still a native plant. It still makes sense putting it in an environment. But it wasn't, if you take a snapshot of Wisconsin, say, 10,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age, it was not one of the things that was growing here. But in the bigger picture, it had a place here. And so native for different people native is different for different people.
Right. Nan, does that feel like it's part of your experience as well? Or yeah, how can we kind of sort through this particular matter?
So, you know, what I tell people and what most native plant experts, educators, you know, people who are steeped in native plant science will tell you that a native plant, you know, it evolved part and parcel alongside with everything else. So all of the fauna and flora that evolved alongside it, the hydrology and weather and soil and all of those kinds of things. So, you know, it clearly... Garlic mustard is not a native plant that came from elsewhere, and it does devastating things to the soil, as we all know. And yeah, a lot of people, you know, as they're eradicating it from a woodland or wherever it happens to be growing, as we should be doing, use it for other kinds of things. Use it for cooking. It's a pot herb. That's kind of an old-fashioned term, but it's an herb. And, you know, it smells like garlic, and you can do wonderful things with it, like put it in soups and stews and make pesto and all that sort of thing. Yes, there really actually is a fairly clear and accept a definition of what a native plant is. And it doesn't really matter how long it goes back in terms of, you know, as compared, like Mikkel said, ginkgo. We also have something called skunk cabbage. Sometimes, you know, people debate upon whether or not, you know, did that arrive with the Ice Age, you know, or was it always here? Well, that's really difficult to know. But yeah, there's a fairly clear definition and a fairly clear idea about what a native plant is. And in Wisconsin, we're extremely lucky because our flora was documented by a fellow whose last name is Curtis. And so we have a pretty good idea of what...
Book that he published.
Yes, exactly. Vegetation of Wisconsin.
Yes.
Prior to... let's see. How do we say this? Some people say the invasion of Europeans, the arrival of Europeans. And when, of course, Europeans came, the face of the landscape changed, sometimes irrevocably.
One interesting thing is that the plant known as plantain has the Native American name white man's footprint. I mean, I don't know what the word is in Ho-Chunk, but that's what it translates as. Mm-hmm. And it's just an example of one of the many things that came here. The other thing I wanted to add to the native discussion is that it gets more and more complex. For instance, earthworms are from Europe. They are
right.
Not native in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Honeybees are not native and actually create havoc among a lot of the native bees. Yet they're absolutely essential for anyone who's growing fruit because you need it. It's one of the main pollinizers for fruit. I mean, there are other bees and insects that pollinate stuff, but the honeybees tend to be the go-to one because you can collect the honey from them also. So it's a rabbit hole that kind of doesn't end. to talk a little bit about the actual native plants I work with, groundnut is one that I sell groundnut online, and I probably sold over 100 pounds of groundnut this year to people who are growing and stuff. It's suddenly become very, very sort of in the popular for people to try. It does have a sort of a context with Native American usage going back. I live close to the Kickapoo River, and there are places where if you're canoeing down the river, you'll see groundnut that is just growing along the river and stuff. So it's been in this area for a long time. The groundnut I grow actually is a selected variety so that the tubers are much larger than a lot of the wild ones. So it's also known as a wild potato. So using it as a potato-like tuber is nice to have larger-sized tubers just because you get more food from it for using. Another quote native plant that a couple of other native plants that I'm really hip on are aronia, which is native in Wisconsin. Aronia is considered one of the seven superfoods that can be grown in central United States. It looks like a blueberry. It's a bush about 8-10 feet tall. It grows. It's native more on the eastern part of the United States. A few people have seen it growing natively around here. Its nutritional profile makes blueberries look like junk food. It is just absolutely amazing in terms of all the anthocyanins and the antioxidants, other kinds of nutrition. I have charts and stuff. I can't pull up the actual facts in my brain. And because of it, there's a whole aronia industry that is cropping up in Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. People are putting in hundreds of acres of it. They're developing. I saw the list once. It's well over 100 different products that they're using aronia for, things like chutney and barbecue sauce, ice cream, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm a winemaker, so I grow aronia for making wine. It makes an absolutely stupendous wine. It's aronia is an astringent berry, so it's not something you're going to pop in your mouth and eat a lot of. It's fairly astringent. So when you're working with it as a foodstuff, you're doing things to sort of level out the astringency. A lot of times aronia is combined with other things just so that it's not so astringent. But as a wine, it's fabulous because it's even more blue and deep than the bluest grapes. So it's the kind of wine that will age for 100 years and still keep and be, you know, get better and better and better. Another plant that I focus on a lot and do a lot with is pawpaws. Now, pawpaws are native only to Quad Cities or maybe a little bit further north, so technically they're not native in Wisconsin. But they grow fine in Wisconsin. Pawpaw is the only subtropical fruit that grows in the upper Midwest. It's related to custard apple. It looks like a mango, and it tastes like a mango crossed with a banana. The trees, as they're growing, look incredibly tropical. The leaves are very, very large. The pawpaw grows in a patch. Some of you might remember the song from the 60s. I think it was on Captain Kangaroo or something, about the pawpaw patch. There's like a kid's nursery song about the pawpaw patch. And so they grow as a thicket, and the fruit is ripe in, October or so. It's just absolutely delicious to eat when it's perfectly ripe. You'll never see pawpaws in a grocery store, because when a pawpaw is perfectly ripe, it kind of looks like a overripe banana. So the skin is black and it doesn't look attractive and so forth, but it's actually exquisite on the inside. So marketing pawpaws has always been, I haven't seen it done successfully anywhere. So people tend to really focus on putting pawpaws in areas where they're just going to use the fruit themselves. You remove the pulp, and it keeps in the freezer for a long time. So I tend to eat them fresh right away, and then anything that's left over, I'll freeze up. And I've been making wine, vinegar. If I'm making like a banana bread type thing, you could use pawpaws, the bands in it. There's actually a pawpaw cookbook. There is International Pawpaw Festival in Ohio, where people come from all over the world. People dress up like pawpaws. I mean, it's really, there's a huge, sort of fan club for making pawpaws more popular. There is a man who has been focusing on breeding higher quality pawpaw varieties, just, you know, larger, sweeter, et cetera, et cetera. They're a little bit more difficult because they need more of a southern environment. Those are a little bit more difficult to grow in Wisconsin. The pawpaws that I grow, I focus on short season ripeners. So my pawpaws are getting ripe like the second week of October, which is in most parts of Wisconsin, that's right about when you start getting the freezes and stuff. It's just an amazing fruit that I'm really like excited about. I saw a lot of the plants and stuff at the farmer's market. So those are a couple of the quote native plants that I do a lot with. I mean, there's other ones also.
Right. Before we get to them, Nan, do you have any direct acquaintance with any of those that he just mentioned?
I know a couple of other permaculturists that grow pawpaws. Another one in Wisconsin, actually. And, you know, I was just thinking about, you know, we were talking about food earlier. there are so many places in Wisconsin, and certainly Racine and Kenosha counties are no different, that are considered food deserts. And you look at school landscapes, you look at church landscapes, and it's nothing but a sea of turf grass, which doesn't benefit anyone. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could transform those landscapes into edible landscapes where there are, you know, nut-producing trees and hazelnuts and berry bushes and, you know, all kinds of things to help transform those areas from food deserts to something that has much more diversity and abundance. It would not only benefit humans, but it would benefit the rest of the natural world as well. And, you know, people can become more self-sufficient by growing those in their own yards. And, I mean, I think it really could be an interesting food revolution, you know, if we were to incorporate those in our landscapes.
Well, especially in schools, it's definitely an educational opportunity, because you could tie science into it, you could tie food and cooking into it, you could tie social issues into it. So it really, for giving kids access to edible landscaping projects, you can, you can teach them in lots and lots of different ways on many levels. And one of the things also I like about edible landscaping environments is they're festive. And so when people gather in these kinds of environments, they feel the fact that there's all this abundance growing there, and it changes how you feel compared to sitting in a giant, you know, like out here, there's lots of yards. People have 3, 5, 10-acre yards, and they mow every last inch of it, and there's no trees on them, no nothing. There's just like these giant yards. And so you can imagine when you know, the difference of feeling if you have an event in a giant field that's just mowed compared to being in the middle of an environment where there's all this fruit growing. It feels very, very abundant and lush. It generates a different kind of spirit in people.
Today is the monthly visit of Nan Calvert, and we're so happy that via the telephone we're joined by Mikkel And. So, Mikkel, our time is beginning to get away from us, but I think we do have time for you to talk about a few more native edible plants that you have some acquaintance with that you want to tell us about.
Well, this one is partially native. I do a lot of work with it. It is a hybrid, and it's actually a natural hybrid of butternut and heartnut, and it's a tree that has been known by various names. I actually use the name Butterheart for it. So it is, butternuts are a fabulous native tree nut that grows in Wisconsin, but they have a disease called butternut canker, and it has literally killed every single butternut that I've ever seen in the area, except for a few giant trees that are like in the middle of a city where they're very, very isolated. And so a butterheart is a cross of heartnut and butternut, and it has much, much more resistance to the disease. Plus, the nuts themselves, a butternut is a multi-chambered nut. So if you crack it open, they're absolutely delicious, but a nut has 10 or 12 or 15 different little chambers, so you just get these tiny little pieces of nuts. So they're easier to use for oil than for eating. But butterheart, they're heart-shaped. When they crack open, a lot of times you get one giant kernel in the shape of a heart from it. They're very easy to crack open. They're very easy to dry. They make a fabulous nut. The trees are fast-growing, although a nut tree will take 12 years maybe for a baby to actually produce nuts. But once they kind of mature, they're called mast years. They have years where they produce a lot of nuts and years where they don't produce so many nuts. But it's a super protein source, very akin to hazelnuts in a way. And they look fabulous. You know, they're like a 25-foot tall, 25-foot wide kind of shade tree. So they function very, very well in the environment. In our community has a permaculture demonstration where we have a food forest, and so the butterhearts are the overstory species in our food forest. I also grow a lot of chestnuts. I guess technically chestnuts may be considered native in Wisconsin. I don't know. It kind of depends on which map you're looking at. There is a lot of efforts to grow blight-resistant chestnuts in Wisconsin. You know, Mark Shepard does a lot of, has acres and acres and acres of different kinds of chestnuts and so forth. Chestnuts have a huge potential also in landscape for, you know, being another protein source. I think, you know, one of the things is that nuts really, like the fruits don't provide you protein, so the nuts are a good addition to your plantings because you're also getting a wider palette of nutrition out of it. And each one of these plants, whether it's a nut or a fruit, has sort of a technology related to it that you have to learn how to harvest, how to work with the fruit, how to deal with the diseases, et cetera, et cetera. And so all of this, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years, and every day I still learn more things. It's not something you acquire overnight. You acquire it by, you know, being open to what's happening and observing, always observing all the different sorts of things that are going on and asking questions. And one of the lucky things for everyone is that when I started out, there was no internet. And there was only magazines and stuff like that. And so if I had a question, it sometimes take me weeks or months to answer it. Now you go on the internet and go onto a Facebook group or something, and you can get an answer to a very difficult question from a nationally known expert in a matter of seconds. You know, it really has changed our access to being able to really figure things out quickly and keep moving forward.
In general, when we're talking about growing native plants, are we talking about growing plants that want to grow and easily grow, or do native plants, generally speaking, need a lot of tender, loving care, need very careful nurturing?
Well, Nan might answer that differently than me. It really depends on, like, I live in farm country out here, and because there are fields everywhere full of farm weeds, I'll give an example. Our permaculture demonstration was started in 1991, so it's almost 30 years old. And until 2 years ago, there was never a single ragweed plant anywhere in the 3 acres. And then the neighbor's ragweed blew over into our place, and literally in the last 2 years, the whole 3 acres is solid ragweed unless I can get out there again and again and again and be removing this stuff. Now, ragweed, if you don't cut it down, it gets 14 foot tall and more than an inch in diameter in the stalk. It's impenetrable it chokes out things, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of caveats about working with plants that need a much less infiltrated environment. A lot of plants would never be able to handle dealing with ragweed coming in even once. I mean, it's incredibly nasty in terms of what it can do to a planting. Plus, I'm severely allergic to it, so there's a double entendre for me.
So there are some real bullies out there, so to speak,
that really have to be
kept at bay for native plants to have a chance.
Yes, and another one that we have that shows in our area a lot is it's called Japanese knotweed or giant Japanese knotweed, Polygonum. It has erased lots of different spaces and stuff like that, and you see it some places where nothing can grow where it's growing. And obviously, there were other things growing originally, and once it gets there, there's literally no way. Like even using pesticides on Japanese knotweed rarely removes it from the environment. But this is our world now. So in my approach to permaculture, it's a matter of dealing with these things. So like with giant Japanese knotweed, it actually, I don't work with a lot of it, but in the old days we used to, it makes like a bamboo kind of cane, so we used to harvest the canes and we made flutes and panpipes out of them. You can actually harvest the tender young shoots, and it's almost like asparagus, but more lemony. It's also used, because we have lime so bad here, it's one of the main ingredients in lime tinctures that people are using. So even though it is erasing environments, there's still ways to work with these things which are just unstoppable sort of invasives.
Anything you want to add to that intriguing final point, Nan?
Yeah, just I just want to back up a little bit and talk about butternut. Butternut, for our listening audience, is in the walnut family. So it's a relative of black walnut. And so a lot of people complain about black walnuts because of the, you know, the rather sizable green nuts that fall on the ground and they stain your fingers brown. But, you know, you can look at it another way in that you can make fabulous dye from those nuts and then, of course, have delicious black walnuts. And so, yeah, the more we can support and promote native plants, whether it's a tree, a shrub, you know, whatever it might be, I think will benefit everybody not only in the long run but also in the short term as well.
Mikhail, and for the sake of our listeners who might want to explore more about the kind of things that you offer, is there a website that they can go to, or is it better for them to make the long trip to visit you in person?
Well, my nursery has a website that's Beyond, B-E-Y-O-N-D, beyondvineyard.com. Also, I'm on Facebook, and so I have a Facebook page called Driftless Sacred Grove, and I also have a Facebook group called Beyond Vineyard, which is my new, I have a whole other project that I haven't talked about, which is basically geared toward making wine, and that's that Facebook group is called Beyond Vineyard.
Very good.
And one other thing I want to put out is, this is not native at all, but it's one of the things that is actually my most passionate about. I grow figs, and I'm pretty much the only person in Wisconsin that sells fresh, local, organic figs at a farmer's market. And so I grow 110 varieties of figs.
Wow.
I'm trialing the fig varieties to see which fig varieties are best to sell to people in Wisconsin that will actually ripen in the length of a Wisconsin season. You have to grow figs in a container because they're not hardy in the ground. But I have some of my figs are 30 years old. They're in 10-gallon containers. They have trunks that are 6 inches around, and they essentially like large bonsais, and they produce fresh figs. And for anyone that has not tasted a fresh fig, fresh figs are the fruit of paradise. So, and I have a Facebook group called Northern Fig Growers. There's about 12,000 people on it. And if anyone in Wisconsin or anywhere is interested in growing figs, you join that group and you'll be overwhelmed because there's people from every country of the world on this group. A lot of people in way, way colder environments than Wisconsin who are growing figs.
Fascinating. Glad to hear that. We'll hope that our listeners explore all of what you just laid out. Mikhail, and I'm so glad that you joined us today on the morning show. This was really, really fun to make your acquaintance and to hear about some of the fascinating things that you are doing. We want to wish you well, and thank you once again for joining us on the morning show, and we will let you go. But thank you again.
Thanks, everyone. Yep, bye.
Bye. All right. Great fun. So glad we got to do that.
Yes.
I understand you have a couple of announcements before we go.
Absolutely. I have a couple of announcements. Riverbend Nature Center is offering a class called Introduction to Sea Kayaking. So that will help you take your kayaking to the next level. Sea kayaks are longer and narrower than recreational kayaks and better suited for larger bodies of water. And during the class, it will introduce you to this world of sea kayaking. You'll kayak in, this is hard to say, kayak in Quarry Lake Park. and they'll work on deep water rescues as well. Space is limited, and it's a very strict limitation. They won't deviate from that. The cost is $40 for members, $45 for non-members. To register, you can call 262-639-1515 or just email info@riverbendracine.org. The first date is Saturday, August 6th from 9 to noon, and then again September 3rd, 9 to noon. Next, we have Hawthorne Hollow's Pike River Concert Benefit Series. Friday, July 22nd, will feature Violet Wilder. This is an acoustic folk trio of multi-instrumentalists, piano, acoustic and electric guitar, viola, percussion, and lush three-part harmonies. The show starts at 6 p.m. in the Hawthorne Hollow Amphitheater. Gates open at 5. Admission is $10 per person. Food and beverages are available for purchase, and also produce from the Heritage Farmstead at Hawthorne Hollow. And that's that.
Excellent. Nan Calvert, in her monthly visit to the program, it's always great to have you here. We look forward to seeing you in August.
Excellent. Thank you. I'll be back in August.
Wonderful. Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be previewing for you something very exciting going